Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the Center for Faith Studies on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Richard Louv, author of Last Child in the Woods, Saving Our Children from Nature Deficit Disorder. He will speak on the topic, Leave No Child Inside. Mr. Louv serves as chairman of the Children and Nature Network, an organization helping to build the international movement to reconnect children with nature. He also serves as honorary co-chairman of the National Forum on Children and Nature. Sponsored by the Conservation Fund, the Forum funds programs around the country designed to get kids outside. Mr. Louv's remarks were given as the first of two keynote addresses at a conference entitled Radical Amazement, The Spirituality of Childhood, organized by the Center for Faith Studies and hosted by Omaha's Countryside Community Church. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, April 2, 2009, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Center for Faith Studies, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Cindy Kugler, Director of the Center for Faith Studies.
And now, speaking of experiences in the woods, I read to you, quote, "If, when we were young, we tramped through forests of Nebraska cottonwoods, or raised pigeons on a rooftop in Queens, or fished for Ozark bluegills, or felt the swell of a wave that traveled 1,000 miles before lifting a boat, then we were bound to the natural world and remain so today. Nature still informs our years, lifts us, and carries us." End quote. This is the opening paragraph of Last Child in the Woods. And I have to admit that author Richard Louv had me from the moment he mentioned the Nebraska cottonwoods. As a grandmother myself, I recently delighted in telling my 6-year-old granddaughter, Lauren, what my own childhood was like. "We used to play out in the windbreak," I told her, "where I had a swing made from a tire. It hung from a cottonwood tree there on our farm. We rode our pony and played with the kittens and skated on the pond. We picked wild raspberries in the woods." Lauren was wide-eyed, taking this all in, and at last she said, "I sure wish I'd gotten to know you sooner, Nana." While this is technically a grandmother joke that circulates on email, we can pause, for there is much truth here. Even a wistfulness expressed by a child for a style of life that includes rambling around freely in nature, armed with a fully operating sense of wonder and delight at what the world has to offer and teach us. Please help me welcome Mr. Richard Louv to Nebraska and to Omaha.
Thank you. And, you know, Cindy gave me the exact same admonition about my speech. No grandstanding, you know. I love the land of Nebraska because I grew up in Kansas City, on the suburban edge of Kansas City, and it looks like this. I also have another connection to Nebraska other than having mentioned it in the first line of the Last Child in the Woods, which is my great aunt was Bess Streeter Aldrich, who I understand is known here. We always considered her the white sheep of our family. Yeah, she was the good one. I grew up hearing stories of her and what a good and kind person she was, and how she began writing when she had to pay the bills when I believe her husband died and she had kids, and started writing a little bit later than most people start writing. I know all about paying the bills with writing, so the talent may not have passed down fully, but the knowledge of that you had to write to pay the bills did. Let me start also by saying that I've learned that many good things are being done here. Ken Finch is here tonight, and he has been working hard for a long time to encourage nature preschools, which is a terrific and very important idea. I just met Mrs. Keo. Did I say your name right? And she told me about her husband, Tom Keo, who apparently was very inspired by Last Child in the Woods in his 80s. And as an architect, helped create a, or led the effort to create a nature playground at the Child Saving Institute. Did I get that right? And she told me a very moving story about that and how he also worked holding babies through some kind of service. I wasn't quite sure I understood that, but that seemed like a wonderful thing to do. Let me begin also by saying that the Midwest, you know, I live in San Diego now, but I've found that the Midwest has a particular feeling for this issue. It may be because nature culturally is closer historically to the surface. The kinds of things my great aunt wrote about aren't that long ago historically. And they're still somehow on the surface in much of the Midwest, as opposed to the coast where other things are on the surface. So I think that Nebraska can very much lead the way. I know when I spoke in Lincoln, I think they turned out like 2,000 people. It was astonishing. It was a great job that they did there. And there are wonderful things happening here. In fact, the Children of Nature Network, which I chair, we held a gathering last summer of leaders from around the country who've emerged in the Children of Nature movement. And we held that in Nebraska. Let me start by also saying that I usually just talk, but this time I felt that because the focus was on the spiritual nature of children in nature, that I should prepare a little more formally. So some of this I will read, which I very seldom do. And then I hope to become more informal, particularly during the discussion period. When my son Matthew, who is now 21, when he was 4, he came up to me one day at my desk and he asked me this question. He said, "Are God and Mother Nature married, or are they just good friends?" I thought, good question. And I have to admit, I laughed when he posed this question. And as I thought about it more, I no longer laughed, at least not in the same way, though there is certainly humor in that cosmic question. Later on, I asked him to ask Mr. Rogers that question, and I'll get back to that. Let me tell you about a fishing trip with my boys, now long ago. The thin crescent slice of moon seemed a rip in the blackness. Deep maroon spread above the island. The mirrored surface of the lake seemed lit from below. The air was cool. Trout began to rise. Coyotes howled and then stopped as suddenly as they had begun. I reached up and banged on the underside of the van's pop-up bunk. "Boys, wake up. Look outside," I said. But of course they did not stir. My older son's hand hung over the edge of the bunk, fingers twitching in sleep. I smiled at his hand and continued to watch the morning grow and expand. In truth, a sunrise is a mundane occurrence, I suppose, happens every day. Sometimes the sunrise is hidden by clouds or smog or sleep. It happens whether we're watching or not. But if we're awake, a sunrise can be a window to something larger. A few evenings after this moment in the mountains, a group of longtime friends got together at our house. The topic of religion and children came up. One friend said he had rediscovered the peace of church and hoped that he could communicate this to his children. He recalled his own childhood experiences at church as less than fulfilling, and the gap between what the adults said on Sunday mornings and what they did during the rest of the week, of course, did not escape him. Yet, he added, without his childhood exposure to church, he would not now find so much comfort in the rituals of liturgy and song. Another friend hesitantly admitted that because she has not introduced her children to organized religion, she feels guilty. She does not believe in religion herself, so she feels that taking her children to church would only teach them that parents are hypocritical. And yet, this friend, who described herself as an atheist, she seemed to me to be more of an agnostic, also remembers intensely spiritual moments as a child, moments when she believed she was speaking directly to a personal God. As an adult, she continues to experience what she calls peak experiences when life becomes blindingly vivid. As she described these moments, her face opened, her voice flowered. Our goal in life, she said, should be to recognize these moments, immerse ourselves in them, honor them, have more of them. I thought of my sons and the sunrise on the mountain. Such moments are the polar opposite of most of our days, when life seems robotic, when we stumble from deadline to deadline, pay the bills, grind through seemingly pre-recorded conversations with our bosses and workmates and even our friends, when we fear that we will be detected for who we are, merely human. Whether or not we take our children to church, part of our role as parents is to guide them to recognize and appreciate these transcendent moments, these sudden connections with something bigger than worries or the world. A few years ago, when a group of local religious leaders, Christian, Jewish, and Muslim, met in my living room, Rabbi Martin Levin of San Diego's congregation Bethel said that to be spiritual is to be constantly amazed. Quote, to quote the words of Professor Abraham Joshua Heschel, a great teacher of our age, he said, our goal should be to live life in radical amazement. Heschel would encourage his students to get up in the morning and look at the world in a way that takes nothing for granted. Everything is phenomenal. Everything is incredible. Never treat life casually. To be spiritual is to be amazed. For many people, organized religion offers the necessary structure, a weekly reminder that there is more to life and afterlife than budgeting and blackness. I have listened to the awesome silence of a church and felt the meaning in the shadows. But since I was a boy, fishing has been my special window to the spirit. Nature has been my window. It is not the only window, but it is a good one. On our recent fishing trip, I waded into the calm water. Not so recent fishing trip. I waded into the calm water, lifting the rod and letting loose the line. I watched my boys along the shore. The younger one, who had given up on fishing momentarily, joyfully hauled his catch of the day, an old bucket, across the mud flats. The older boy had taken his rod into a thicket where there was a secluded pool. Perhaps in that place he was immersed in that quietest, strongest of voices. Sometimes the rhythm of the rod is not unlike a chant or the swinging of incense. And sometimes you can feel the water, almost know beforehand that it will bulge beneath a fly. Mine did that now, and a big trout lifted from the surface, caught the sunset on its orange flank, and above the water stopped in time, as did my children and the world. And then life went on. In a few hours, the boys and I would begin to miss their mother, and we would head home more amazed by the sunrise and the sunset, by light and dark, by small muddy shoes on the stairs, or the sound of my wife's hairbrush, by the smallest of moments. Not until the 1960s and the 1970s, really, did the spiritual life of children become of much notice. For whatever reason, perhaps it was Freud's take on children weren't really seen to be all that spiritual. Robert Cole's book, The Spiritual Life of Children, helped change that view. My experience since Last Child in the Woods came out has taught me quite a few things that I did not understand when I was writing the book. One of those is that there is something about this issue of children and nature that touches people in a place in their heart that I'm not sure very much else touches. It doesn't seem to matter what somebody's religion or politics are. They almost always want to tell me about the treehouse they had when they were kids. That special place in the woods or along a stream that they went, that was their place. It doesn't seem to matter what their religion or their politics are. They all have that place if they're old enough to have had that experience in their heart. I wrote a chapter in Last Child in the Woods near the end of the book. I put it there because the issue of spirituality makes people nervous. So I put it at the end of the book. And the name of the chapter is The Spiritual Necessity of Nature for Children. I was worried about that chapter. I have a very conservative Christian friend. I ask her to read the chapter. I actually do want to bring people together, not push them apart. I quote her in that chapter. The reason I did that is because, as she educated me, I know that there are people who feel that someone like me will come along and try to convince their children to worship nature. I don't really do that, but I don't really agree with her, but I respect her point of view. So I was very careful with that chapter. It says what I wanted it to say, but it says it in a way that I hoped would not turn people away. I didn't need to worry. Not long after the book came out, one of the chief first proponents of the book on his radio program and on his blog was the president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. Very conservative guy. Last year, I was asked to be on the 700 Club on the Christian Broadcasting Network. Now, I never thought that I would be on the 700 Club. I figured the only way I'm getting into heaven is on my wife's guest pass. And some people that I work with, including someone who's high up in the Sierra Club, were very worried about me going on that show. They thought, this is an ambush. But I went ahead and did it. And they did a great job. They did a great piece on nature deficit disorder. Pat Robertson talked about it after it ran on the... It was amazing. That's another reason for radical amazement. It was very good. Now, that I shouldn't tell this in church, but I was really pleased with my presentation. They taped it in Washington, D.C. I walked out of the studio. I went out on the sidewalk, and I looked down and realized my zipper had been down through the entire Christian Broadcasting Network interview. Another reason for radical amazement. You know, there are these moments when, you know, I don't usually use the word God very often, but there are these moments when you learn the true moment, your true position in the universe, just when you think you're really impressed with yourself. When my first book was in the early 80s, I was on an airplane. I was supposed to be on the Phil Donahue show, which was a big deal then. And I was in an airplane, and it was when it was being taped in Chicago, and the airplane was starting its descent, and I was in the bathroom, and I was supposed to be on the Phil Donahue show in just a few hours, and I knocked my glasses off, and they went into the thing, and it's going like this, and I'm watching in slow motion my and I'm blind without my glasses, and I'm supposed to be on Phil Donahue, and my glasses are in this green stuff going down, and I went diving. And my arm was up to here. You know, and that's one of those moments when you're, you know, the Greeks called it metanoia, you know, when your life, you know, your true position in the universe becomes very, very clear. So, radical amazement. And I did get them, by the way. I got my glasses. I think that we need to listen very, very carefully to the way we talk about nature and the way, in particular, our kids talk about nature. In 1995, there was an MIT study that was, at that time, the most extensive survey of how Americans really thought about environmental issues. The researchers were stunned by what they discovered. They noted an increased environmental consciousness observed in language. For example, a patch of land once referred to as a swamp was more likely to be called wetlands. That was good news. What they also noticed was that the environmental values had already become entwined at that point with core values of parental responsibility, and they considered that a major finding. A substantial majority of people surveyed justified environmental protection by explicitly invoking God as the creator, with striking uniformity across subgroups. So what was going on there? Why should so many non-believers argue on the basis of God's creation, the researchers asked. It seems that, they wrote, divine creation is the closest concept American culture provides to express the sacredness of nature. Regardless of whether one actually believes in biblical creation, it is the best vehicle we have to express this value, unquote. If the MIT report was correct, spiritual arguments for the environment, seldom used by the environmental movement, will be far more effective than utilitarian arguments. What they were amazed with is the fact that everybody, including atheists, used religious or spiritual terminology when they talked about nature. Including atheists used those types of phrases and words. Recently, we've certainly been seeing an emergence of an evangelical, faith-based environmentalism in the book. We've seen a surgence of that. But I think that we need to listen even more carefully than we do to our own language to what our kids tell us about that experience. Psychologist Edward Hoffman believed that children under age 14 do not have the capacity or language skills to describe their early spiritual experiences in nature. But my experience has taught me that children and young people have much to tell us about nature and the spirit if we care to listen. Consider this tale, the one that ninth grader Kyle Wallstedt shared with me about what he called the spot where he found his moment of amazement. This is Kyle speaking. As long as I can remember, every time I heard the word nature, I thought of a forest surrounded by mountain peaks seen off in the distance. I never thought too much of this until one year when I was on a family vacation in Mammoth Mountain. I decided I would try and find a place that was similar to the place I have thought about since I was a kid. So I told my parents I was going to go on a walk. I grabbed my coat and I left. To my surprise, it only took about 5 or 10 minutes to find the spot. I stood there in awe. It was exactly how I imagined it. Dozens of massive pine trees were visible. Maybe 100 feet from where I stood, snow lightly covered the ground. Pine needles were scattered about. Out in the distance above the trees was a breathtaking view of the mountaintop. To my side was a small creek. The only sound I could hear was the trickling of the water and the occasional car on the highway not too far behind me. I was in a starstruck daze for what seemed to be 5 or 10 minutes, but that turned out to be 2.5 hours. My parents had been looking for me because it was getting dark. When we finally met up, I told them I had gotten lost, for how could I share such an experience, such an overwhelming religious experience? This episode really made me think about the real meaning of nature. I have come to the conclusion that one's idea of nature is also their idea of a paradise or a heaven on earth. In my case, I felt perfect. I felt perfect when I was at the spot. That's a ninth grader speaking. I mentioned that I would talk about Fred Rogers a little bit. Mr. Rogers knew how to listen. A few years before he died, I interviewed him for my newspaper column. I took my son, Matthew, who had just turned 6. My son has always been ebullient and outgoing, but on this day, he was tense and silent. As I introduced him to Mr. Rogers, I noticed that my son's upper lip was quivering. Rogers smiled and shook his hand. Later, he interrupted his conversation with the adults and sat down next to Matthew, who had pulled a book about rocks out of his little backpack. "I love rocks, too," Mr. Rogers said. Mr. Rogers told him that he owned a lapidary machine, which he kept in an outbuilding on his property because of its constant whirring sound. Matthew's eyes widened because his own birthday present had been a lapidary machine that year to roll and polish the most beautiful rocks that he collected. Mr. Rogers and Matthew leaned together over the pages of his book, whispering the secrets of stone. I remembered that Mr. Rogers was an ordained minister, so I mentioned to him Matthew's theological question about God and Mother Nature. Are they married or just good friends? When my son had said this, as I mentioned, I had involuntarily laughed. Mr. Rogers did not. "That's a very interesting question, Matthew." He thought about it for a long moment. "Your mom and dad are married, and they've had two fine boys. And they're mighty important to those two boys. And I think that's one way we get to know what God and nature are like, by having a mom and a dad who love us." Maybe the statement wasn't exactly politically correct, what about single parents, but it worked for Matthew. Then Mr. Rogers said something so quietly that only my son could hear, and Matthew smiled. Later, as everyone prepared to leave, Mr. Rogers sat down next to Matthew and said to him, "Will you let me know, as time goes by, what answer you find to your question?" I never knew what they said. And a few weeks later, we got a card from Mr. Rogers. Mr. Rogers held up a camera, his own camera, and took a picture of Matthew. And here was a picture of Matthew from Mr. Rogers in the mail with a little note. Years later, when Matthew was in high school, he wrote a long letter to Mr. Rogers about the answer that he had found to that question. And Mr. Rogers wrote back a beautiful short letter and said to say hello to your father. I have never learned what the answer Matthew found to his question or what the discussion that went on for some years was about between my son and Mr. Rogers. But I, too, learned something from Mr. Rogers that day. I asked him, this is not long after Eddie Murphy did his Mr. Robinson's Neighborhood Member on Saturday Night Live. And we were in a room there where there were several people, and I asked Mr. Rogers, "Did that bother you?" And he kind of shifted the subject a little bit. But later he came up to me, and this was after his conversation with Matthew. He came up to me and he took me aside and he said, "You asked me an honest question. I'll give you an honest answer. Yes, it bothered me a lot." He said, "But what I have learned is that the greatest gift that you can give is the gift of your own true self. So that's the mantra that I repeat to myself when I'm nervous before a speech today. The greatest gift that we can give is the gift of your own true self, whatever that self is. That's all you really have to give. It seems to me that nature gives us that gift. It gives us its own true self. One of the reasons that I think that religious leaders have been very helpful to the book and now are being very helpful, could be more helpful, but are being very helpful to what has become a movement to reconnect children with nature, both in the United States and outside the United States now. I puzzled over why I got that response, that unexpected positive response. I came to the conclusion that smart religious people of whatever kind intuitively understand that all spiritual life begins with a sense of wonder. And what is one of the first windows to wonder? It's not the only window, but it's one of the most important. Perhaps if you're like me, you remember a time when you crawled out through the grass, perhaps to where the grass ended and the weeds and the rocks and the trees began, and you found a rock and you turned it over and you discovered for the first time that you were not alone in the universe. And that feeling of awe and wonder at that moment, and when you first heard wind in the trees, and when you first heard voices in the woods that were being spoken in ways that were not audible. That moment, those moments of wonder and awe, how in the world can we shut that window for children? How can we turn them away from that? How can we say it's better that you spend your life preparing to take tests? How can we tell them that they can sit on the couch and find a sense of wonder playing Grand Theft Auto? How can we do this to our kids? And that is what we are doing to so many of our kids. Usually in my speech, and we'll deal with this more in the discussion, I spend a lot of time describing how this disconnection between children and nature is growing so rapidly within the last three decades primarily. And that when we talk about this, this is not an exercise in nostalgia. When you think about it, for all of human history and prehistory, children went outside and they played and they worked in nature for most of their developing years. And within the matter of a few months, we're seeing the virtual potential disappearance of that experience, the closing of that window, if we're not careful. Our generation, many of us are baby boomers here, we may be the last generation to have a memory of a time when it was considered normal and expected for kids just to go out and muck around in the woods and dig a hole and build a fort, and listen to the voices in the woods that are less than audible. How can we take that memory with us when we leave this earth? Mine was allegedly a cause-oriented generation. I sometimes think that this could be our final and most redemptive cause, to make sure that we are not the last to have that memory. Recently, I've been, and I'll end with this and then we'll go to the discussion, I've been thinking a lot about this question. Do children have a right? Do we, as adults, have a right to a connection to nature? I began to ask that of my friends. And to my surprise, my friends who are probably 98% environmentalists, were very nervous. Some of them were made very nervous by that question. It made them uncomfortable. Over time, I began to understand there are several reasons for that. One is all we need is one more reason to sue people. The minute you start talking about rights, then you're talking about litigation, etc. But I really am not speaking about this in a legal sense, per se. I'm talking about it in a moral sense. But the other thing I came to understand is that some people who are environmentalists, and I consider myself an environmentalist, some people at the far end, and believe me, I've heard from them, of environmentalism, really don't want more kids in the woods. They view nature as separate, as in fact superior to human beings, and human beings should stay out of nature. I've heard from them. Now, on the other end of the political spectrum, the far end of that political spectrum, the very far end, there are people who believe that, from a religious point of view, that nature does not count, it does not matter, that it was only put here for human dominion, not for our stewardship, but for our dominion. And at best, it's a stepping stone on the way to true paradise. What's very interesting to me is that at both ends of those extremes, the view of nature is very, very similar. Nature is the other. It's not us. I don't think that we are going to make the progress that we want to make as a species with our relationship with nature as long as we think of ourselves as separate from it. In our time, Thomas Berry, who I've gotten to know, has presented this inseparability most eloquently. Thomas Berry, as some of you know, is a Catholic priest to the Passionate Order and founder of the History of Religions program at Fordham University and the Riverdale Center of Religious Research. And for the better part of his 94 years on the planet, Thomas Berry has seen things in a more clear way than almost anybody I know. He's considered one of the world's leading eco-theologians. I met him at the end of my official book tour 5 years ago. This is the book tour that never died. And this was a kind of a hors d'oeuvres gathering to mark the official end of it in North Carolina. And there were people from Nature Conservancy and Sierra Club and Audubon and other people there. And all of a sudden, the crowd parted, and this old man who looked a lot like Mr. Rogers comes through the crowd, and he is revered there. He is revered in North Carolina. He's revered in many quarters. His books have very much been formative in terms of how we think about eco-theology. He came up and he grabbed my hands and he said, "I've been waiting for 10 years for someone to write this book." And I was told later that that was the first time that he had been away from his assisted living home in 3 years since a stroke. And he had spent the weekend reading the book. Berry presents kind of the religious side or the spiritual side that E.O. Wilson talks about. E.O. Wilson at Harvard came up with the biophilia hypothesis a few decades ago. The biophilia hypothesis holds that human beings are hardwired to need nature, that if we don't get nature, we don't do so well. If we don't get our hands dirty and our feet wet from time to time, he says we are genetically wired. And in fact, studies have been done of the kinds of images that human beings are attracted to all over the world, showing them lots of images. Every kind of culture, urban, rural, Africa, Europe, etc. Natural images, images of nature are the number one image that human beings are attracted to. And of those, landscapes, the number one image that human beings are attracted to is the savannah. So where are we from? Lots of studies have been done that we can talk about later about, you know, people who are in hospital beds who have a view of a natural landscape as opposed to a view of a man-made landscape. The people with the natural landscape view get well faster. These are not crystal theory studies. These are real hard science studies. There is something in us that needs nature that we don't fully understand. E.O. Wilson approaches that from a biological standpoint. Berry incorporates Wilson's biological view within a wider cosmological context. In his book, The Great Work, he wrote, "The present urgency is to begin thinking within the context of the whole planet, the integral Earth community, with all of its human and other than human components. When we discuss ethics, we must understand it to mean the principles and values that govern that comprehensive community. The natural world is the physical manifestation of the divine," Berry believes. "The survival of both religion and science depends not on one winning, because then both would lose, but on the emergence of what he calls a third story, a 21st century story, Now, Barry, I should add, at 94, and I saw him last year. I went to his, I drove over to his assisted living place and saw him again. He's 94, and he doesn't like talking about the 20th century. He spent his whole life there. He wants to talk about the 21st century. And he has a degree of radical amazement that you wouldn't believe. Speaking of absolutes, moral absolutes may make us uncomfortable, but surely this is true. As a society, we need to give nature back to our kids and ourselves. Not doing that is immoral. It is unethical. As Barry writes, a degraded habitat will produce degraded humans. If there is to be any true progress, then the entire life community must progress. In the formation of American ideals, nature was elemental to the idea of human rights. Inherent in the thinking of the founding fathers was this assumption: with every right comes responsibility. Whether we are talking about democracy or nature, if we fail to serve as careful stewards, we will destroy the reason for our right and the right itself. Those of us who identify ourselves as conservationists or environmentalists, whatever word we prefer, nearly always have had some transcendent experience in the natural world. That's what the studies show. Almost to a person, anyone with a who is a conservationist, environmentalist, and an ecological conscience had that experience. What if that experience dries up? Where will the future stewards of the earth come from? There will always be environmentalists, but if we're not careful, if we don't make sure kids are bonding with nature now, I'm afraid that environmentalists in the future will carry nature in their briefcases but not in their heart, and that's a very different relationship. Almost always, environmentalists, conservationists had some transcendent experience in the natural world when they were kids, usually in the form of independent make-believe play with hands muddy and feet wet. We cannot love what we do not know. As Robert Michael Pyle puts it so well, what is the extinction of a condor to a child who has never seen a wren? I tell the story in the book, and I told it in an essay that I did a while back for Orion magazine. It's available online. The article is. And I'll end with the story of a little girl that I met in my own grade school. When I went back to Raytown, Missouri, and went to Southwood Grade School to interview kids, Southwood Grade School had not changed a bit. The same linoleum was on the floor. The same teachers were there. They had not aged. I made that last part up. The teacher brought in several classrooms of kids into one room. And before I began, she said, "I want you to listen very carefully, in particular to one little girl." She called this little girl our poet. So as I was interviewing them, the typical comments by kids about their experience in nature were there, echoing what I'd heard from one little boy in San Diego already who said, "The reason I prefer playing indoors is because that's where all the electrical outlets are." They didn't go outside very much, even though in this school they seemed to go outside a little bit more than they did in most of the other schools I'd gone to. But this little girl spoke, about 10 years old. She said, "When I am in the woods, I feel that I am in my mother's shoes." And then she talked about her special place in the woods. She described it as a big tree. And under the tree, there was a little hollowed out area that she had made. And she kept her blanket down there. And she would go down to her special place and lie on her back and look up at the leaves and the branches. And she would think of her poems. And then she said, "One day, I went down and my tree was gone. And my hollowed out place was gone. And my blanket was gone." And she added, "When they cut down my tree, I felt that they had cut down part of me." Now, I don't think that little girl was speaking metaphorically. I think she was speaking literally. When they cut down my tree, they cut down part of me. Now, I don't think that little girl had a specific right to that specific tree or that specific woods, but she has a right to a connection to nature. And the reason is because if E.O. Wilson is right, if Thomas Berry is right, and if that place in your heart that still may exist is right, then that place in your heart that you first experienced in nature, that you took that place with you that you used to go to, and it's still there, that is fundamental to your humanity. That is fundamental to our humanity, that connection to nature. Anything that is fundamental to humanity, we have a right to. We have a human right to. Now, I don't know how to enforce that, but I do know that begins when we decide that that is something that every child has a right to. The environmental justice movement is primarily about the toxins that get dumped in inner city neighborhoods. Recently, Van Jones, who talks about green jobs, has been saying that inner city kids have a right to the good stuff of nature. And he defines the good stuff as green jobs. To that, I would add, they deserve the good stuff of nature, all the health that nature brings kids, and we'll talk about that more in a minute, all of the studies that show that attention deficit disorder gets better with just a little bit of contact with nature, that kids are more creative in a natural setting, that kids do better on test scores when schools have outdoor classrooms, that kids have a better body image if they have a disability when they spend more time in nature, that kids feel connected to their communities when they spend time in nature, that kids feel more whole when they are in nature. Our kids have a right to that. As I said, the little girl in Raytown may not have a specific right to that particular tree in her chosen woods, but she does have the inalienable right to be with other life and to liberty, which cannot be realized under protective house arrest, and to the pursuit of happiness, which is made whole by the universe. Someone have a comment or a question? Yes.
It seems like we talk a lot about children and adults and how they are supposed to interact with each other, with nature, but it seems like a lot of, like, as a teenager, I feel like we are not talked about, and what do you think our role should be with that?
That's a great question about teenagers. First, let me say something about parents and kids. I talk about a lot about parents and kids. One of the built-in paradoxes of this issue is that one of the main reasons, I believe it's the main reason, that kids aren't going outside as much now, or the parents aren't encouraging or letting them, is because parents are scared to death of stranger danger. That is largely created by my profession of journalism. Particularly, all you have to do is watch CNN or Fox, and you'll see how they take a handful of terrible crimes against children and repeat them over and over and over again. That's the very definition of conditioning. That doesn't mean there isn't risk out there. There is. But we need to begin to think in terms of comparative risk. There's a huge risk of raising a generation under protective house arrest. Pediatricians now say that this generation of children will be the first in our history to die earlier, to have a shorter life expectancy than their own parents. That's a real risk. The built-in paradox is, because that fear is not going to go away, because media is probably going to change anytime soon, in order, realistically, to give kids some semblance of independent play in nature, unstructured independent play in nature, the irony is we're probably going to have to structure a lot of it. We're going to have to organize a lot of it. Not structure the actual play, but we're going to have to do more through our churches with nature preschools. We're going to have to do more in our schools with nature classrooms. We're going to have to do more as families to get ourselves off the couch and get out there with our kids, etc. And we're going to have to learn to stand back and let them dig a hole. This is not about hovering over our kids in the woods with nature flashcards. Now, to get to your question about teenagers, I'm really glad you asked that. Not long ago, I was asked to speak at a high school near where I live, and I didn't want to do it because I was tired and grumpy, and I was just back from a trip. But then I started thinking, I wrote this book about kids, and I started feeling guilty, so I did it. I expected 20 kids at the high school, and there were 200 of them waiting for me. They'd been given extra credit. I spoke for about an hour, and you could have heard a pin drop, and it's not because I'm a great speaker. I'm not. It was something else. They were really paying attention. I talked about two things. I talked about the fact that their health, not an abstraction, their health and the full use of their senses, which we seldom do in this society, use all of our senses at the same time, but their health, their psychological health, their physical health. I started telling them about all the studies that showed how connected that was to their experience of nature, and their health could be greatly improved, enhanced, with just a little more time with nature. That was the first thing I talked about. The second thing I talked about was the fact that because of climate change and these major environmental issues that we do face, whatever we want to call them, everything in the next 20 years must change. Everything in the next 40 years must change. We need new kinds of energy, of course, already beginning, new kinds of agriculture, it's already beginning, new kinds of architecture and urban design, it's already beginning. We can talk later about that. The idea that we can produce, redesign our neighborhoods, redesign our homes, we can redesign new workplaces that incorporate nature into our environment, all of our environment, not just out there, but here. And the studies have shown that when that is done, for instance, in workplaces, from a design point of view, it's called biophilic design, that productivity goes up, sick time goes down, turnover gets better, et cetera. So in other words, the future is not just about sustainability. Sustainability, that word is a problematic word because it means too many things to too many people, but also it suggests stasis. Now, no self-respecting, creative 16-year-old is interested in stasis, and neither is the creative 16-year-old that's also inside all of you. What we want to do is create. So the future is not just about saving energy. It's about producing human energy by creating a society where nature is at the woven into the society at every level. What if we had a society in which nature was woven into our lives every bit as much or maybe more than technology is today? What would that feel like? The studies certainly suggest we'd be a lot healthier, we'd be a lot happier, and we'd probably be smarter, too. So when the kids left, I turned to the biology teacher who had invited me, and I said, you know, those were high school kids. I didn't expect them to be paying attention. You know, I expected gum smacking and note passing. Now, that was the teachers, by the way. They were doing that. But they were really paying attention. Why was that? And he said, easy answer, Rich. You said something hopeful about the future of the environment. They never hear that. I think that, now I'm a journalist by trade, or at least I used to be, and so I don't like happy news for just happy news sake. And I think we ought to be doing more reporting about the bad news, but we've been missing two-thirds of the story, and the two-thirds of the story are the fact that everything must change. And we may, without meaning to, be entering the most creative period in human history because everything must change. Now, to a 16-year-old, that's great news. Martin Luther King said in many ways that any movement will fail if it cannot paint a picture of a world that people will want to go to. I think we've been failing, particularly when we talk to young people and to ourselves, in the painting of that picture, and we've got to start painting. I think somebody, yeah.
I'm a school teacher in Chicago, and I think a lot of my parents are under the philosophy of the protective house arrest kind of a thing, and I was just wondering, I teach third graders, and do you have a kind of an introductory step that the kids could take or that I could help the kids take to kind of get out into nature, do things like that, like something small so we could kind of start the ball rolling?
Well, the new edition of my book, we added a 10,000-word section, new section at the end of Last Child that's called a field guide. It has 100 actions that communities and families can take, and teachers also, and architects and so forth. So there's some good stuff in there. More importantly, there are links in that section to places on the web like the National Wildlife Federation and other people who also have material on that. There ought to be a lot more material out there than there is, and it ought to be a lot more sophisticated than it is, particularly for teachers. And by the way, as a teacher, one recent study showed that teachers who get their kids outdoors don't burn out as fast as kids as teachers who stay inside the classroom. And there's also a recent study, and I can't remember these exact figures, but it looked at preschools, and it found that something like 94% of the time that kids are in the class in preschool is sedentary. And even when they go outside, something like 56% of the time is sedentary outside. So much work has to be done in this. And teachers really are at the front lines of this. And they're often way ahead of this, way ahead of their administrators and certainly their school boards on this issue. It's going to be tough to reform the public school system and systems in particular. But, I assume that as a teacher that you're trying your best to do that. And you're one of the heroes then if you are. Thank you.
You've been listening to a program from the Center for Faith Studies on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Richard Louvre, author of Last Child in the Woods, Saving Our Children from Nature Deficit Disorder. He spoke on the topic, Leave No Child Inside. Mr. Louvre's remarks were given as the first of two keynote addresses at a conference entitled Radical Amazement, The Spirituality of Childhood, organized by the Center for Faith Studies and hosted by Omaha's Countryside Community Church. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, April 2, 2009, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Kugler of Countryside Community Church for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Listen next Monday, August 10th at 12 noon for the second keynote address from the Radical Amazement Conference. The speaker will be Susan Lynn, Associate Director of the Media Center of the Judge Baker Children's Center, an instructor in psychiatry at Harvard Medical School, and author of Consuming Kids, The Hostile Takeover of Childhood. She will speak on the topic, The Case for Make-Believe, Why Play is Essential to Body, Mind, and Spirit. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.